radiofonica.com.
Ciao Florenzo, ma ti vedo raggiante questa mattina, che è successo?
Già, prima di uscire di casa ho ascoltato Radio Visioni, il programma sul cinema, tutto da ascoltare.
Ah sì, su www.radiofonica.com, la web radio con molti programmi di spessore culturale tra l'altro.
Ma sì, c'è pure Universo Parallelo, un nuovo programma, tutto di cultura.
And welcome to Short Science, your international era-spanning portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke, and today the show is being taken over by
Tom, Jack and Charlie, and today we'll be talking about all things fishy.
So a bit of a different show coming up for you today. This is Short Science. So, welcome to the show. Now, in just a few moments, I am going to be handing over the whole show to Charlie, Jack and Tom. But just before I do that, I want to tell you about next week's show. So, next week we will be back to our regular format, and that means that we need you to phone in your contributions for the show. So, the topic is going to be IQ. So, what do you think about the idea of measuring IQ? Is having a high IQ a real indicator that someone is clever or better than someone else? Does IQ measure how well we get on practically in the real world, or is it just an intellectual idea? Are people clever in different ways? Is there a type of intelligence that's more important than other types of intelligence? What does it even mean to be intelligent or clever? So call in your thoughts to +447401 856 681, or you can email material to studio@shortscience.co.uk. So now, back to today. Gentlemen, introduce yourselves and tell us about what we can expect in the show today.
Well, my name's Tom and I am a science communication student here at Imperial College and, more importantly, an experienced piranha fisherman.
Hi, I'm Jack, biologist, an extreme angler by trade. I'm also a sci-commer.
And I'm Charlie, and as you might have guessed, I'm also a sci-commer, and I also have the unfortunate position of having to live with these two people. So, what are we going to be talking about today, Tom?
Well, first we'll be exploring the weird and wonderful ways that fish are adapted to their natural environments by taking a look at their fishiology.
Ah, sounds interesting. And then, on a more serious note, fish stocks are declining worldwide, but is it too late to save their biodiversity? And more importantly, when you're buying fish and chips, should you buy haddock or should you buy cod?
Finally, we take a look at some monsters of the fish world and the mischievous people-eating antics.
So, we've got so much to look forward to in the show today. So, coming up first then, it's time for the Short Science News in Brief.
So, the news. And sticking with the theme of fish, we've got some news stories for you coming from the world of fish. So, Tom, what have you got for us today?
First up, we have fish oil fails. Fish oil capsules do not slow mental or physical decline in Alzheimer's patients, according to a new £7 million study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Fish oil supplements are rich in the omega-3 fatty acids and are thought to benefit brain function, but previous trials have also suggested they may slow or prevent mental decline in Alzheimer's. But researchers followed 300 patients at varying stages of Alzheimer's for 18 months and concluded there was no cognitive difference between those taking the fish oil and those that weren't. However, supporters of fish oil point out that the latest study did not investigate whether supplements could ward off the onset of Alzheimer's in the first place. The new research may also undercut a multi-million pound industry based on belief in fish oil's medical benefits.
Yeah, a lot of 6-year-olds will be happy with that, not having to take their fish oils every day. That's good. So, Jack, have you got some news for us?
I certainly do. New fish discovered in Deep Ocean Trench. A brand new species of fish has been discovered in what was previously thought to be a lifeless deep ocean trench. The new kind of snailfish is a ghoulish pale white colour and makes its home at the incredible depth of 7 kilometres in the Pacific Peru-Chile Trench. Marine biologists from the University of Aberdeen lowered specialised deep sea imaging equipment into the trench to take pictures of the mysterious local. Large groups of cusk eels were also observed at slightly shallower depths, which the research has described as another scientific first.
Wow, great stuff there. OK, so I'm going to be talking about evolution by supernatural selection. The religious ceremonies of an indigenous people from Mexico have caused an evolutionary change in a species of fish. For hundreds of years, the Zoc people from northern Mexico have been releasing a natural toxin contained in the plant Barbasco into waterways in order to paralyze the fish and collect them for fertility rituals. The Barbasco contains a poison which prevents the fish from respiring. So areas where Barbasco use was common had fish that were significantly larger than other areas, as they were able to more easily fight the effects of the poison, and so they didn't get caught. So it seems religion, then, isn't always fighting evolution. In some cases, it's actually helping it along.
Okay, now I've got some more genetics for you. A new gene that enables fish to change colour in order to match their surroundings has been identified. The gene is key to the fish's survival and allows them to hide from predators and prey. This phenomenon, known as background adaptation, is also observed in mammals, such as the Arctic hare, whose camouflaging coat turns from brown in summer to white in winter. In fish, however, the new gene enables them to change colour in response to changes in their environment in a matter of minutes. The researchers, who were from Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, discovered the gene in thousands of species of bony fish, such as zebrafish, trout and salmon.
Okay, talking about salmon, my story is called The Salmon of Doubt. Unfortunately, it's not about Douglas Adams, but it's about an Atlantic salmon that's been genetically engineered to grow twice as fast as conventional fish. It was produced by an American company, and they gave a growth hormone from some fish, some Cherokee fish. Normally, these Atlantic salmon only produce the growth hormone for part of the year, but the company added genes from Chinook salmon and an eel-like fish to allow the fish to produce growth hormone all year long, so allowing it to grow more quickly. So critics have labelled this new salmon, obviously, Frankenfish, saying that it could produce allergic reactions in humans. The American FDA points out that the new fish were biologically identical to conventional salmon and would therefore be no more allergic. And all the new fish would be female and sterile to prevent them from escaping and interbreeding with the wild salmon.
Next up, a heartwarming story about an unlucky pelican. A pelican has narrowly escaped death after getting three fish hooks caught in its stomach. Following a lengthy and difficult operation at the Taronga Wildlife Hospital in Australia, the bird was well enough to be released. But this was the second visit in as many months for the bird, as a month earlier it was caught in an oil spill, and staff had to spend 4 days painstakingly cleaning oil from its feathers. Anglers have been warned to avoid feeding pelicans because they have been conditioned to approach humans and fishing lines for food.
Right, guys, I've got some serious news here. Fisherman catches monster goldfish. A fisherman in the south of France has captured a giant goldfish the size and weight of a three-year-old child. Raphael Baghini spent 10 minutes wrestling the ferocious beast into the shallows. He later described the catch as the surprise of his life. Local anglers had previously caught fleeting glimpses of the monster, and it was known in the region as the legendary giant goldfish.
Wow, some very interesting news indeed today. Now, if anybody has any questions about any of our news, you need to send an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Well, it's very exciting. It's time now for our first capsule of the day on fishiology.
Right, so we're going to take a look at fishiology, some of the amazing and frankly bizarre ways that fish are adapted to their natural environment. First up, we've all seen footage of flying fish. They soar out of the water, they flutter majestically into the sunset.
But Jack, I don't mean to undercut your feature, but I've heard that flying fish don't actually fly. Is that true?
Yeah, the short answer is you're bang on there. They don't actually fly. What's going on here? Well, basically, they leap out of the water and glide using their specially adapted pectoral fins as sort of crude wings. It's pretty good, though. It allows them to reach distances of 50 metres. And as well as this, they're beating their tails around 70 times a second and tilting their bodies slightly upwards so they get some lift, which is always going to help them out. Now, if they hit an updraft, they can also gain extra lift. In fact, when conditions are right, they've been recorded to get to 20 feet above the surface of the water.
20 feet, really? I mean, that's pretty impressive, but it's not flying, is it, really? Maybe they should change their name to Glidey Flappy Fish instead. They're not really flying, are they?
It doesn't really have the same ring to it.
No, I suppose not.
Why do they even bother? What are they doing, like, flying out of the water? It seems a bit of a frivolous activity to me, like joyriding for fish.
Yeah, if you picture the scene, so there's a couple of hungry barracuda chasing them up the surface. I mean, you're going to get eaten unless you can think of something pretty special. So leaping out of the water and flying away, or gliding, is what they actually do is going to help.
Well, I've actually heard some Japanese fishermen have actually started taking advantage of this, and they're just getting nets and actually catching the fish as they jump out of the water, so they don't really have any hope if they're getting caught under and above the water. They're not doing very well, really.
Flying away from one predator into the arms
into another one.
Mm. Well, I've got another kind of fish-related escape mechanism trying to get away from predators. Like, I'm going to be looking at pufferfish. I mean, the pufferfish is part of this huge farm that includes, like, balloonfish, blowfish, bubblefish, globefish, swellfish, tape, all sorts of interesting fish. But again, the pufferfish, as soon as a predator comes nearby, because the way it moves, it uses all these different kind of fins to swim, and it gives it this great maneuverability. But a consequence of that is that it's an extremely like slow fish, and so if a predator comes to get it, it can't get away. So it's evolved to have this ingenious tactic whereby it pumps air or even water into its body, and so essentially turns itself into a like giant beach ball. And all of a sudden, this predator that thought it had hold of this kind of tasty morsel is faced with, well, a massive beach ball in its mouth and just doesn't know what to do.
Couldn't it just play around with it? That's what I'd do. No. Certainly wouldn't eat it, would it, then?
Well, it's probably a good job it isn't eating it, because actually the pufferfish has this really toxic neurotoxin inside it called tetrodotoxin, which is lethal to like most mammals and especially humans, despite the fact that it's actually a delicacy in Japan in this kind of dish that's known as fugu. But yeah, like the toxin has all sorts of strange behaviour. Like when it's given to humans in small doses, it can induce in them kind of like a coma-like state. And so it was used in voodoo medicine, and is where the term zombie came from, because these people would kind of go into this coma-induced state for several days and arise from it as though they were coming back from the dead.
Oh, crikey! So how are they actually puffing up then? How's that working?
Oh, they're just essentially pumping water into these special sacks they have inside themselves, and then turn into a massive beach ball.
Yeah. I've actually heard that when they do that, it actually rips their internal organs, and they can only do it once or twice in their lives. So not really the best evolutionary advantage.
I think
they're
dangerous when they do it out of water, and when they start engulfing air, they find it very difficult to deflate themselves, and then just kind of get stuck, stranded as a beach ball floating.
They don't start floating up into the air, do they? Never seen that.
No. But it'd be interesting to see what happened if you did fill a pufferfish with helium.
Oh, that's shocking stuff anyway. And talking about shocking stuff, I'm going to be talking all about the electric eel. And what might surprise you most is they're not actually eels, but they're actually a type of knife fish. So they're more closely related to the carp. And so they have thousands of specialised cells called electrocytes down the length of their body. Each cell only produces a small voltage, but when they discharge simultaneously, they can emit a burst of over 600 volts.
That's a lot, Charlie. Are they lethal to humans?
Human deaths are pretty rare. You've got to be pretty unlucky to die from one. I mean, if you're in a place with dozens of them, maybe multiple shocks could cause heart failure. But generally, they only hunt for invertebrates and small fish and mammals, so we don't have much to worry about. But these cells, they're actually evolved from muscle cells. So when I contract my huge biceps, as the other two can see here now, each muscle cell produces a small electric charge in order to contract. And the electric eels have taken this to an extreme and using this electric charge to stun their prey. And they can actually use a low-level electric charge as well to do something called electrolocation. So they produce a low field, and whenever a fish swims nearby, it disturbs the field and allowing the eel to find it and hopefully find a nice tasty meal.
So, that's great. Well, I've got a question for you. Who do you reckon would win in a fight between a flying fish, a pufferfish, and an electric eel?
Oh, that is a good question.
Well, I think the flying fish, it would just run away. It's not going to fight, is it? It's a scaredy cat.
I guess they're both having defence mechanisms, so it's going to be the electric eel that's going to...
I think so. Sting them. I think he's got the edge.
But what about that neurotoxin, I reckon? The electric eel tries to get a tasty morsel out of it. He's going to be in for trouble.
Well, I think we need to experiment.
Okay.
Well, three definitely very interesting, very different types of fish there.
Right, so the scale of overfishing. We're going to talk about the problem. Obviously, the explosion in human population in the last 100 years has put severe demand on fish stocks to feed us.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard about 50% of the human population relies on seafood or fish.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many people living around the coast that it's a primary source of nutriment for so many people. And basically, the advancement in technology is allowing us to meet this need. But at the detriment of fish stocks. They're crashing.
What, these are advances in what kind of shipping, or what, like what's happening? Is it that people are just catching more and more fish?
Yeah, so the, like echolocation and specialised nets that
it can be like 4 kilometres in length, I think.
I guess, yeah. Communications as well. Like, as communications improve, then as soon as fishermen find some fish, then they all just send out their message and
yeah, they're straight there, for it. And yeah, they just don't have a chance. So basically, a pretty well-known example of this is in 1992 off the coast of Newfoundland. There was a cod fishing fleet that basically decimated the local stock. They just completely pummeled it into the ground. There was nothing left. So the American government had to step in and retrain all these fishermen because they're out of a job. They've lost their livelihood and they know nothing else. And in the end, it ended up costing them about $2 billion in sort of retraining costs. And
gosh,
how might you go about solving this problem? Like, what kind of, you know, we talked about technology, but surely we can also apply our technology to find new ways to feed ourselves the fish that we obviously want to eat
in a sustainable way.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea. Obviously, we're setting up fish farms all the time in a sort of attempt to grow our own stocks and not have to take away from what's out there in the wild. But
are there any disadvantages?
Yeah, they have their own problems associated with them. So take the example of salmon farms. They're setting up these unnatural sort of populations of salmon in the mouths of rivers, sort of maybe in Vancouver and in Scotland, and they attract salmon lice, which are small parasitic sort of crustaceans that attach themselves to the skin of these adult salmon and sort of pierce that skin and feed on blood and mucus in a pretty disgusting way, really. But because they're in the mouth of rivers, all the juvenile salmon after the hatch are swimming past them, and they're too young to deal with these parasites, and they're just getting infested, and basically they are sucked dry before they could even reach the sea. And you know, it's a pretty big problem.
That is awful. Yeah. As I was talking about in the news, Barbasco use in Mexico is making a fish evolve bigger. Well, in fact, the problem of overfishing, it's actually causing a lot of fish populations to evolve smaller.
Why does that happen?
Well, generally, the fishermen, they want to catch the biggest fish. So the bigger fish are extracted, the smaller fish get thrown back, or they're never caught in the first place. And these small fish have to take over the breeding roles. And so these smaller fish are actually breeding earlier and earlier.
Do fishermen really throw them back? I thought they just wanted all the fish they could get. It doesn't matter what size and shape. I mean, something's got to go into Tesco Value Fish Fingers.
Something. I'm not sure that's even fish, though. So, I think they've got regulations now where they have to throw away the smallest ones. And these smaller ones...
Well, even if they're dead.
Oh, well, because it's by number quotas, and so if they can only fish a certain number, they want to get the biggest in that number.
And they want the biggest ones, yeah. So when you have a particular subgroup of individuals, let's say the biggest fish, constantly being selected, you're going to get an evolutionary change. So the trend is for fish to become smaller and mature earlier. So as Jack was talking about, there was a 1992 crash in cod in the North Atlantic, and this caused the cod to breed an entire year earlier. And it used to be thought that young fish were actually helpful in that they would be faster and more prolific breeders. But it's turned out a study in 2005 shows that offspring from these young fish are actually weaker and they're more likely to die. So as well as overfishing, it's causing an evolutionary change which makes the fish population weaker and therefore less likely to carry on in the future. So it seems like, sorry to excuse the pun, but overfishing is a double-edged swordfish. As it were.
Oh dear.
Sorry about that.
All right. So what are we going to do about this overfishing? How are we going to stop it?
Well, as you say, the most obvious way is just to stop fishing entirely in those areas where they've collapsed. So in 1993, there was a moratorium on fishing in the North Atlantic. The average sizes of cod increased, but the numbers haven't really returned in the numbers they wanted. So a better solution would be to start managing the populations before they collapse, which makes sense. So there are various ways this can be done, by either limiting the catch or limiting the number of boats out on the water. Another alternative way is the marine protected area system, is where they have these series of safe places in the ocean where fish can live and breed and be happy and dance around and not get attacked by fishermen. And so that there are currently 5,000 of these across the ocean, which makes up almost 1% of the ocean surface. And it's been proven to work in many areas. Fish numbers are coming back where these marine protected areas are around. So in Iceland, California, Queensland, fish numbers are coming back up in significant numbers. So maybe there is hope after all.
So is there hope for me having cod with my chip still, or is the dream over there?
Well, in actual fact, the majority of cod that is sold in supermarkets, frozen meals, and even from your chippy is from sustainable sources. And so, yeah, this may allow you to have cod with your chips. But the problem with this is that all you're really doing by changing to sustainable stocks is shifting the problem around the globe. You know, a stock that is sustainable, if demand rises, it could very easily become unsustainable. And so what's recommended, rather than going for cod with your chips, is maybe to go for the more kind of obscure varieties. You know, you've got your pollock, your lemon sole. And by doing that, you're going to take the pressure off the most popular and most pressured species.
And I've heard if you use a smaller fish like a mackerel. Is mackerel a small fish?
It's quite small.
And sardines, they're apparently more sustainable. So if you like sardines, that is.
Yeah, right. I know. And Pollock's pretty tasty as well.
Yeah. Mm. He's a good artist as well, Jackson Pollock.
I think any of these fish that sort of are quite small, so they breed quite regularly rather than having to wait a few years.
Yeah.
That's when there's a problem. Mm. If something's taking 10 years to reproduce, then. Mm.
As well, like a lot of, people are becoming more and more concerned about this issue, and so fish shops are taking it on themselves to work out where their sources are. And so, you know, just ask the man behind the counter, he'll probably be able to tell you if your cod is sustainable or not.
And following in the immortal words of George Bush, I think it would be helpful if man and fish could coexist peacefully together. There is hope for them, maybe.
I think that would benefit us all.
But anyway, who wants fish anyway? I mean, doesn't it... I personally, I'm not really that keen on it, even though we're talking about it for an hour. But it just smells so bad, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And the reason for that is fish tissue contains this odourless chemical called a trimethylamine oxide. The problem is when you kill a fish, these tissues get exposed to air, and so you get this bacteria coming in, and they start to break down this chemical. And the kind of chemical pathway that it breaks down to are actually derivatives of ammonia. And this is what kind of causes this, like, horrible smell.
The eggy smell.
Yeah, and so really, if your fish is smelling when you cook it, it's stinking out your house, you've probably got old fish. You should just, you know, have a word with your fishmonger and tell him to get his acting gear.
Okay, well, from sustainable fish to stinky fish, I think we will leave it there. Well, it's time now for our last fishy feature of the day, monster fish.
Sorry, I just have to say that salmon dance, what a great tuner. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that, should I? No, probably not. Anyway, this third feature we're going to be talking about is all about monster fish. So why Jaws, for example, is a terrifying feature film by Steven Spielberg, but why...
Yeah, great white sharks, they are the monster fish. That's what everyone thinks of it when you...
The demon fish. Terrifying, aren't they?
Huge as well, like, you know, 22 feet. I think I read a story the other day, like, that's unbelievably huge.
You just can't imagine that coming out of the water to get you.
No,
but I don't think it happens that much, really. People are sort of terrified of it when maybe they shouldn't be. People don't even go in the bath sometimes. They're so scared.
There's some statistic, isn't there, like, you know, you're more likely to kind of get struck by lightning than you are to be killed by something along those
lines. Probably.
But, you know, the few cases that do happen, like, why does it happen? Why do sharks go for humans? I wouldn't have thought they'd particularly want to eat a human.
Well, I think it's probably because we do look a lot like seals and turtles when we're splashing around in the water, especially surfers. If there's any surfers out there listening, stop acting like seals and turtles.
Yeah, if you can just imagine the silhouette against the sun from the view at the bottom of the ocean. It's just like four sort of arms sticking out outside of a surfboard.
Exactly.
I guess you're right. It's our own fault in a way. Yeah. It's, you know, not the shark's fault.
We just look too delicious, I think.
Well, I think a lot of the time when they do sort of, when they grab on, they realise, oh, this doesn't taste very nice, and then they spit it out.
Mm. Does anyone have any good shark attack stories?
Good, I'm not sure. It's pretty terrifying, this story. But it occurs in the Second World War. So there was this American warship, the USS Indianapolis, if I said that correctly, and it was split in two by Japanese torpedoes. So when the rescuers arrived 4 days later, they found over 500 people dead. Many of them had been chewed to pieces by sharks, probably because they looked too much like seals. So Woody James was one of the survivors, and he said, the sharks were around, hundreds of them, everything would be quiet, and then hear somebody scream, and you knew a shark had got him. So and that's pretty terrifying.
That is terrifying.
Oh, yeah, it's the stuff of nightmares. But it turns out that you're not even safe in freshwater these days. Basically, there's a species of shark that can infiltrate freshwater.
You're joking.
No, I'm not. I am not. In in the Brisbane River in Australia, the Ganges in India, the Mississippi in America. It's there. It's everywhere, basically.
But how can they survive there? You know, rivers have fresh water. Sea has salt in it. Like, there has to be, you know.
Yeah, when I put salt,
some change to their physiology.
Yeah, when
physiology.
I put salt in my fish tank, the fish dies.
Well, it's this creature, this bull shark, which is actually the third most dangerous shark there is, anyway. So what it can do is when it enters a freshwater system, it can begin to excrete 20 times as much urine as it does when it's in salt water. And what that acts to do is bring its blood to the same sort of osmotic state as river water rather than seawater. It's less salty. It's not going to lose all of its bodily moisture. So it will travel up these rivers and it will have a look around and it might have a nice meal and then it might go back. But unfortunately, there's been increasing problems with them getting stranded because in sort of the Brisbane River, there was in 1974 there was this horrible flood, and it meant that the sharks could access lakes. They could get over weirs into places they previously couldn't. So they did, because they're naturally curious. And when the waters receded, there were these trapped, isolated populations of bull sharks.
Wow.
With only a limited food source. So they've been starting to move in on livestock when people bring their horses to water for a drink.
They've not gone out onto land, have they? Because that'd be terrifying.
No.
You're telling me a shark's taken down a horse?
He's had a good go. But yeah, they've also unfortunately started taking people, and these populations, terrifyingly, are definitely breeding in these isolated lakes.
Well, they're growing, you mean?
Yeah, they're growing and they're breeding, and they're obviously, the more there are, the more they have to look to these horrible food sources.
And that sounds pretty terrifying, but I was researching for this feature, and I heard about there was this shark called the Megalodon, and it was over three times the size of the great white shark. So can you imagine, I mean, how big that is? Just imagine that in the water behind you. So
yeah, it sounds terrifying, but you're assuming that it's the biggest fish that the most terrifying. I've got a monster fish that is tiny, yet is arguably the most terrifying of the lot. And it lives in the Amazonian River. You've got piranhas there, you've got giant anacondas, all sorts of really frightening things. But this fish is about the same size as a toothpick. In fact, it's colloquially known as the toothpick fish.
Doesn't sound so scary.
Well, the proper name is the candiru. You think, what could something that small do to me?
It's cute.
But we can see why it's scary for humans if we consider like its normal kind of feeding behavior. It's a parasite, and it kind of swims around in the depths of the river, and it senses the traces of urea and ammonia coming out of other fish's gills, and uses this to direct itself towards the fish, swims into the gills, and then latches into the fish and basically like digs into an artery and just starts like sucking its blood, and it's and so feeds and lives in this way. And its barbs are pretty terrifying. Like, a lot of the fish that the host fish don't actually survive because there's so much damage to the fish.
I mean, that sounds terrifying for a fish, but last time I checked, I wasn't a fish. So why would that be terrifying for me?
Well, it's not uncommon for people to go swimming or bathing in the rivers, and sometimes, you know, if they're a little bit desperate, they urinate in the water, which, you know, as you know, also contains your urea, ammonia kind of compounds. And so you've got your candiru fish swimming along, and, you know, it senses the ammonia. It thinks, oh, this is a tasty fish for me to latch onto. Swims up the stream, and, you know, the expanded urethra goes inside, and then you can imagine the shock on their face. And they're trying to, like, grab hold of this, stop this fish going inside, but it has these barbs. You can't pull it back out because, you know, it's like a spit. You know, when you put it in, you try and pull it back
out. Can you stop talking about this now? Not nice.
And, you know, and for a long time, people thought they were just making this up. It was kind of like folklore. You know, there was this legend that, you know, men would kind of choose castration as an alternative to like the pain of having this fish inside them. But in the first kind of verified instance of this was only in 1997.
Really?
This guy had to have like kind of 3 days of like excruciating pain and extensive surgery to get it. But because, you know, when the candiru fish has like latched on and like had its fill, it's become too big to get itself back out, and so
it's just too greedy for its own good.
It's just stuck inside there. And so yeah, the only way that they can get rid of it is surgery. There's this other known, I guess, like traditional medicine that's made from these two herbs. One called like the Genipapo plant, and this thing called the Buritash apple, and so they use this to basically kill the fish and then slowly dissolve it out. But yeah, it's
Well, terrifying for men. I think women probably going to be pleased they don't have to deal with that issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say so. It sounds pretty horrifying. And even as a girl, I have to say, my stomach was turning over ever so slightly during that. Now, we have had a really fantastic show so far, but I have a feeling that things are about to get a little crazy with this week's quiz. So thanks again to James F. for his fantastic quiz jingle there. So now, boys, let's start off. What's your first quiz question?
Right. What is the size of the smallest fish in the world?
Well, the Kandiri fish that I was talking about is pretty small. It's got to be pretty small of it.
Well, speak for yourself.
That's the size of a toothpick. The fish, yeah, the Kandiri fish, is the size of a toothpick. So I don't reckon it'll get much smaller than that.
How big is a toothpick? About 4 centimetres?
Oh, I'd say maybe 3.
3 centimetres?
So saying 3 centimetres.
I'm going 3 centimetres.
Charlie?
I think I'm going to go smaller. I'm going to be sneaky and say 2 centimetres.
Any reason?
No, just so if I'm closer, I'll be closer. I'll win, I think. So.
Oh, there's a strategy involved.
Yeah, a lot of things.
I see. Well, I can tell you, it's actually the Pedo cypress fish found in Indonesia, which is 8 millimetres.
Less than a centimetre.
Less than a centimetre, so take your biscuit there, Charlie.
Right, a truly tiny fish. Okay, what's your next question?
I'm going to ask this one, Jack. What is the colour of an octopus's blood? What do you think?
I don't know, octopus seem like fairly, almost like translucent. I imagine it'd be like, it couldn't be red because they just...
It'd be red.
Yeah. I don't know, I'm going to go for green.
Green, just a random colour. Green. Jack, what are you going to say?
I think you're being sneaky here, Charlie. I reckon this is a trick question.
You think I'm double bluffing you?
I think you are.
I think it's red?
I'm going red.
Really? So you're saying red, Tom's saying green. Well, actually, the answer is blue. An octopus's blood is blue.
Very aristocratic.
Yeah.
Oh, you're Darren Brown me there.
Yeah.
And is octopus blood different to the ink that they produce, or is that just squids?
I think it's only squid that produce ink, but it is different than blood. I think instead of iron, it uses magnesium or something else to the pigment to bind the oxygen to. So that's why it's a different colour.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, and your next question.
I'll field this one. In years, how old was the oldest ever fish recorded?
Oldest fish? I don't think you could get a fish bigger than older than... probably 50 years, but wouldn't it get eaten? Do people eat koi carp? I don't know.
Well, then they just get a bit older and wrinkled after 50 years. Not really want it. No, it's got a wrinkly skin.
Do you think there's a little home somewhere where these
retired koi carp somewhere?
They're no longer beautiful and ornamental. Well,
it's true. Well,
like I know galapagos tortoises can get to, what, 150 years old. There's a hint for you.
Well, people in Japan live a very long time, so I'd assume it's the same thing for their fish. So I'm going to say older than that, say 180 years.
Well, I don't think it's that long. I'm going to go 20 years.
Only 20 years?
Yeah, there can't be a fish that's older than me.
It's either going to be big or actually really small.
If you combine your two answers, then you get the right answer. It's actually 200 really? Years old.
200. Wow. So, yeah, we're
me and Jack
were
right. Half point each.
Half point each. Yeah.
Super old fish. Okay, what's your next question?
Okay, guys. How many species of fish are there in the entire world?
Have you counted them?
Yep, myself.
You counted them all?
This morning.
Right. Yeah, we were quick there. Okay, well, I mean, there's about 3 million species of animals, I think, I heard somewhere. So
what percentage of animals do we think are fish?
Yeah.
That's the question.
That's the question. It's a tricky one. I thought
most of the animals are supposed to be insect, like kind of little bugs,
that's
aren't they?
True. So millions of them.
We can wipe out like 80% just from that. Okay. And then you'd be split, you know, mammals, birds, fish, maybe.
Yeah, vertebrates.
5%. Maybe. So
I don't know what 5% of 3 million is. But, I'll say 20,000.
20,000.
No idea.
Oh, I think it's more than that. 100,000.
100,000.
Well,
what's the answer?
Well, you'll be desperate to know.
I'm desperate. On the edge of my seat.
So far, we found 29,000 species of fish. Yeah, that's all I found
just this morning.
But according to the internet, there's still 25,000 yet to be discovered.
Reliable source.
How can they estimate that? It's just like, oh, we don't know what's there, so I'm going to guess it's probably the same again.
It's probably not too far away from that logic. They make little curves, don't they, based on how many they found and how the amount they find is decreasing over the years.
Yeah, so I don't know how they do it. I'll probably find out at some point. But.
So the actual answer is there. We don't actually know how many species of fish there are.
A lot.
Yeah, a lot. We'll go for that. So now you have one more question for us.
Okay, if an adult salmon lays 3,000 eggs on average, how many will develop into breeding adults?
Well, that's a sad question. I would have hoped it would be all 3,000. But I'm guessing it's not. Otherwise, we wouldn't be answering this. So,
Don't bears. Bears get in there and...
I think they prefer the salmon to the eggs.
The eggs. Do people eat salmon eggs? I know they eat other fish eggs, but salmon eggs, are they...
I've definitely seen on David Attenborough bears eating fish eggs. Definitely.
Do they? So probably not many then. I'll say 300.
So about 10%.
Yeah.
I'm going for... So it's out of 3,000.
Yeah.
I'm going for 12.
12?
12, that's a very low number, Jack. But it's actually only two. Far less than that, an extremely small percentage of eggs, so only make it.
They're
just replacing their population. So two breeding pairs, a breeding pair will only produce two children to adulthood. So it's just
essentially
makes sense, I suppose.
But then salmon numbers are declining as well, so obviously
it must be less than two.
Yeah. Well, interesting stuff there in the quiz. Now it's time for you boys to say your goodbyes. It's nearly the end of the show. So, any final words for us?
Well, I'd just like to thank Elizabeth for having us here, for taking over the show, for trusting it.
You're very welcome.
We've
done a very
whale
good job.
Of a time here in the studio.
we've got time for one more fishy pun, if you can squeeze
sad.
One out.
We're very sad to be Finn-ished.
thanks for tuning in.
We're going to have to draw a line there. Okay, so that's about all we've got time for this week. Now, don't forget to phone in with your thoughts on IQ for next week's show. The number again is +44 7401 856 681. That's 07401 856 681. Or you can email in any material or questions for us to studio@shortscience.co.uk. You can also check out our website, shortscience.co.uk, for more information about next week's show, how to get in touch, how to subscribe to our podcast, and a whole lot more. So thanks ever so much for today's Takeover presenters, Charlie Harvey, Jack Croxall, and Tom Luton. Thanks once again to James F. for his brilliant quiz jingle. My name's Elizabeth Hawke, and I have been your host for this very special episode of Short Science. Now, I took care of the production here in the IC Radio studio, and the theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design. So thanks very much for listening, and join us again next week for another episode of Short Science.
Radiofonica.com. It's been 7 hours and 15 days since you took your love away. I go out every night and sleep all day since you took your love away. Since you've been gone, I could do whatever I want. I can see whomever I choose. Eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant, but nothing, I said nothing, can take away these blues, 'cause nothing compares, nothing compares to you. It's been so long.
Radio Aperitif. Sette note per sette DJ. Ogni venerdì dalle 19 alle 23 alla Tana dell'Orso, via Ulisse Rocchi 32 a 150 metri da Piazza Grimana. Drink e buffet 5 euro. DJ set e videoproiezioni. Non perdetelo. Radiofonica.com.
Ciao Debbie, sono appena uscita dalla manicure.
Oh ciao Gioia, ti trovo bene nonostante la cronica situazione di conflitto nella striscia di Gaza.
Striscia di che? La notizia?
Beh, poi dobbiamo considerare la grave recessione economica in cui stiamo qui in Italia.
Ammazza Debbie, ma come sei strutta! Ma tutto questo l'hai letto dalla parrucchiera?
Ma no Gioia, ho ascoltato i programmi di informazione su www.radiofonica.com.
Davvero? Ma che scherzi?
No no, te lo dico proprio. Per esempio c'è Fonica News, Revolver, Formalmente Informale e Metropolitan.